Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. And today, I'm stepping back in front of the microphone. I have a different role in the organization now, but I'm stepping back in front of the microphone to talk with Kelly McFall. Kelly is a longtime and excellent host on the network. He hosts New Books in Genocide Studies. And today, we'll be talking about his book, which is really about teaching history, called The Needs of Others: Human Rights, International Organizations, and Intervention in Rwanda, 1994. And it's published by Norton, no less. So, Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Absolutely. Well, could you tell us a little bit about yourself just to begin?
Sure. I teach at a small Catholic school in Wichita, Kansas, called Newman University. I got there by way of large public universities. I attended Michigan State as an undergrad for the sound and excellent reason that Magic Johnson attended there. And to a 16-year-old, that seemed important.
It's important.
I then went to get my MA and PhD in military history at Ohio State, or the Ohio State, I suppose I should say.
The premier program in military history in the United States, I should add.
It was an excellent experience. And I then took a one-year job at Wichita State as a sabbatical replacement. And as academic careers often go, there was a small school an hour north of there called Bethany College that that had a job opening. And the right people knew the right people. And I got an interview and the job. And I discovered that while I had gotten a great education at Michigan State and Ohio State, I really fell in love with small liberal arts schools where I could get to know my students on a personal level and where they could challenge me to learn new things in ways that I didn't often get at a big public institution. That's how I ended up becoming interested in the history of mass violence. Some of my students, after having taken a Holocaust class from me, asked me to do another independent study class on genocide. And that was, I think, 11 years ago. And that has become one of my primary interests. It's also a school that has both Bethany College and Newman, where I now teach, are both schools where probably a third to 40% of the students participate in sports in one way or another. And so that led me to an interest in sports history, which is another one of my interests. So teaching at a small college is, I have found particularly rewarding because of the emphasis on teaching. I enjoy research. I think it's incredibly important, but my joy comes from teaching and helping students understand the past and how the past impacts the present. And being at a small school has let me explore that and led to my interest in reacting to the past.
Great. Well, we'll talk about it in a second. The one thing I should add for the listeners, and they may know this if they heard any of my prior interviews, because I always stick it in. I'm actually from Wichita, so I know all these places really well. I grew up there, so I know Bethany and Newman, and I grew up a Shockers fan, the Wichita State Shockers. Yes. And I was a big basketball fan back in the day. So
Yeah, Wichita is a place close to my heart. I don't know if I have any relatives. I don't think I have any relatives there anymore, but I know that we have family reunions in Kansas. The Poe mm-hmm. family does. So I may be going to one this summer. I'm not sure. So let's talk a little bit about reacting to the past. Can you explain in brief what it is and how it came to be as mm-hmm. a pedagogical project?
Excuse me. So reacting to the past originated about 20 years ago at Barnard College, which is, I think technically it is a sister institution of Columbia, but I may have the technical language wrong. In a classroom taught by Mark Carnes, who teaches American history, he's probably familiar to many people who do American history. He's written a number of books. And as an effort to improve our ability to engage students in the past. And what it is a series of what we call games, and we can talk about terminology in a minute if you'd like, but games in which students are embedded or emplaced in a moment in the past, a moment in which there is a society perhaps in crisis, perhaps simply engaged in a great debate about an important value or an important decision that it has to make. And so these students are given a role in that debate and asked then to make decisions about where that society should go. So, for example, students might be given roles in the National Assembly or as citizens of Paris in 1791 when the French are trying to figure out where the revolution should go. Or they might be given roles in Athens immediately after the Athenian defeat by the Spartans and asked to figure out what Athens should be now that it has lost a war. Or those are both high politics games. It might be that they are in Greenwich Village in a coffee shop or a bar trying to figure out what the role of women and unions and ordinary people should be in this time of change. So it's a way of engaging students in great questions and great texts, a way in which instructors step back. It does not mean that instructors don't do anything, but instructors step back and students take over the classroom and drive these debates forward.
So I have a lot to say about this, obviously. We talked a little bit before the interview. Yeah. And one is that I really appreciate this approach to teaching, primarily because I think lecturing is not a good way to teach. Mm-hmm. And I, as I said in the pre-interview, I gave up lecturing, I don't know, it was about 15 years ago back when I was still a professor. I just said, look, for all I can tell, this is a waste of time. Most people are not paying attention. Maybe it was the way I lectured. I don't know. But I was a pretty good lecturer, and it just seemed to me a bad way to convey the information and to get people to think historically. So I taped my lectures, and then I started to do other things with the valuable class time, because that in-person time is valuable. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you ever worked in a corporation, you know how valuable face time is. That's like, yeah, not something to be wasted. And I felt it was being wasted. But I also like the kind of gamification of these things, because I grew mm-hmm. up as someone who, I played a lot of board games, and they were historical board games when I was young. And these really got me very interested in history. And in mm-hmm. this case, they were like Avalon Hill and strategy and tactics war games. And they were complicated. But they did ask you to think historically. You didn't have you just necessarily had to think historically, because in order to be the character you wanted to be, you had to learn about the character. There wasn't any other way to do it. You can't just make stuff up. So I think the approach is really terrific. And the third thing I would say is this really models the way that you do research. I mean, if you're thinking about why Caesar crossed the Rubicon, you got to become Caesar for a second, man, and think about what Caesar wanted to do and how he, you know, what his goals were, what kind of opportunities he had, what challenges he faced, how it weighted up in his mind. You kind of have to recreate that. There's actually a technical word for this in historical methodology. It's called the Verstehen method. It's a German word. It just means understanding. Mm. But you just do this all the time. Like I just finished a book myself, and I had to try to think about what the actors were doing, because they didn't tell us. And so I had to recreate the situation in which they were acting and try to almost simulate in my mind what they were doing. So I think it really asks students to do the same thing, and it recapitulates historical research and historical inference. I think I would call it that, historical inference, very, very nicely. So can you talk a little bit about the current state of reacting to the past before we get into the details of how it works? That is, how is it organized? How is it funded? Norton is on board to publish it. Are there resources available for people that want to use it? That kind of thing.
So reacting to the past, as I said, started out as one person's brainstorm in one classroom. It has grown to become institutionalized. We have a board that oversees an organization that organizes conferences and works with publishers and provides game designers and instructors with advice about how to design games and use them effectively. We run a series of conferences across the country, with the big one, the annual Institute in New York in June. It won't happen this year for obvious reasons, but every year we do that. We run one in Athens, Georgia in the January. And then across the country, there are ones in various colleges and universities that are designed to help people who are not familiar with the pedagogy to understand it and to help them make informed decisions about whether to use it in their classroom and help them learn how to be better teachers using reacting to the past. And then we also use a variety of, modern media, modern communications technology. There's an active Facebook page with, which is probably the most active Facebook page I've ever seen in terms of offering advice to instructors and to people who are interested in using the materials. There's a well-developed editorial process. Head of the editorial board that functions as part of this broader reacting consortium likes to talk about how there's more peer review for reacting to the past games than any traditional manuscript, because they go through an editorial board through reacting, and then it also goes through the Norton process, or alternatively, there is a reacting consortium press through University of North Carolina that does publish some games as well. But in either case, you get three complete blind editorial reviews for the scholarly quality of the game, but also for playability. So it's still very wiki in nature, and it's a remarkably welcoming community of scholars. But it has become institutionalized in order to give either current or prospective users support and inspiration.
So how would somebody start to become involved? How does someone get involved?
You should not do what I did.
Okay.
And so that's maybe not true. You can do what I did. What I did was a friend of mine who taught at Wichita State knew that I was trying to get away from lecturing and sent me a link and said, you should do this. And about 5 minutes later, I put book orders in saying, well, I'm going to run the French game next semester. And this is how it goes, right? You send an email to the bookstore, and then you press send, and you sit back and you say, oh, shit, did I really do this? Then I went to a conference, and that was the right way to do it. So one way to begin this is to attend a conference and to experience it for yourself. We don't often allow ourselves to be students as college faculty. And I think we miss a lot in terms of what works and what does not in teaching because we don't have the student experience. And so conferences allow you to play it from the perspective of a student and get a sense of what their experience will be and about the kind of dramatically different opportunities and values you will get from playing these as compared to a lecture. And so that's, I think, the best way. But it's not impossible. It is possible simply to run a game even without playing a conference, simply by going to Norton or going to Amazon and finding a game that fits your course, right? One of the things we say is that these games are ways of helping students understand the past and the present. And you play them for that reason. We call them games because that is an attractive title. Students like the idea that they will play games, and therefore we can fool them into actually learning a remarkable amount of material. And so you pick a game that makes sense for your course objectives, and plunge in.
So just to continue on the logistical path here. So the first way you do it is probably to attend a conference or something like that. You would contact Norton or somebody involved in the editorial board, and then you attend a conference. Is that right?
So there's a webpage for the Reacting Consortium, reacting.barnard.edu, but you can simply search Reacting to the Past and it will come up. And it has, among them, it has a list of all of the published and games and games in development. You can find upcoming events there. You can find resources for instructors. That is, to be honest, that's probably, if you step back, that's the first thing to do is to go to the website and explore.
Yeah. But you would say to people, it's best not to do this alone. So it's best to attend a conference or something like this, or at least, I don't know, lurk on the Facebook page or seek assistance before you just jump in and do it.
So let me take a step back, because what you see on Amazon is the game book, which is what students will buy. What you don't see on Amazon, you'll get from Norton or on the Reacting to the Past website, is really extensive resources designed for the instructor. So the game we're going to talk about today has an instructor's guide that's about 120 pages long. It is not something you pick up and read from start to finish at any one time, but it is kind of a step-by-step handbook walking you through the game and what you need to do on any particular day and what problems might come up and how you would solve them, right? So there are support materials that make it possible. But yes, fundamentally, I agree. You should not do this alone. That does not necessarily mean you should be at a conference, although that's a great way to start. But it does mean, at least I would encourage listeners, if they want to try this, to get on the Facebook page and to ask questions, because there's a remarkable amount of expertise out there, people who can help you think through how this game might be used and how to solve any problems you have.
And do you have any idea how many instructors are using the Reacting to the Past technique?
We know there are hundreds of colleges where instructors are using it. Mm-hmm. We know we have about 2,000 instructors on the Facebook page. Mm-hmm. We don't know. There are probably other people out there who have never been in touch with us who use it, so we don't have an absolute number, but hundreds of colleges and thousands of instructors.
Mm-hmm. So how many games are there in the catalog? And we won't go through them. I just want to give people an idea of how rich it is. Yeah.
So there are about 15 or 17 published games where students will get a game book from a publisher, Norton or Reacting Consortium Press, often Norton, that will look like a traditional book. The thing about games is that they have to be effective. I mean, they have to work, and that takes playtesting. And so there's another set of probably 15 or 20 games at various points in development that have been used in classrooms across the country, but have not gone through the kind of final editorial stage to get published. So you can use 40 or so, probably.
I see. So this leads naturally to my last question. Say you're a veteran and you've used this for a while, and you know, I say to myself, well, there's nothing in here about the Russian Revolution, and I'd like to do one on that. What should an instructor do then?
You go for it.
I was afraid you'd say that.
What I didn't say is that, so as I said, we have a pretty rigorous editorial process. That's intentional. We want to make sure that these games are of high quality enough that any student who encounters them, even if they encounter them at a low stage of development, is going to have an effective experience. But there are dozens of games that people have kind of started working on at one stage or another, and and used in their classroom and have not come up. And almost everyone who becomes interested in this pedagogy says, huh, there's not the game here that I'm really interested in. Maybe I should work on it. And I say, that's great. The more opportunities we have for students, the better off our students will be. And as I say, we have a pretty sophisticated institutional base that can help people who are interested in writing a game to think about what that means and how to do that well.
Well, I'm sure Norton is interested in expanding the number of games that are available. And I imagine there are a lot of people who are history instructors that would be interested in getting involved. I know that if I still thought I would, I mean, it sounds absolutely fascinating and it's certainly better than lecturing. At least I think it is. I don't know.
I agree entirely. But what I will also say is that writing a game is kind of a remarkable scholarly experience. It is different than writing traditional historical manuscripts.
Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. So to write a game, the first thing to say is that a game is an interpretation. I mean, maybe not true for Clue or Sorry or something like that, but the kind of games we're talking about, there is a historical interpretation embedded in the game, right? The roles that students will embody have victory conditions. They can win or they can lose. And there is kind of an expected, or rather the game leads students to make decisions that will align with historical reality. Now, that is not to say that the games have to turn out the way history did, but it does mean that if you've got your incentive rights for the character, the incentives right for the characters, they will make decisions that mirror what happened historically. These games are based on the idea that persuasion works, right? And so it is possible. Every game includes roles that are called indeterminates, people who can be persuaded. And if you can present a view of the world or a view of the future that persuades those indeterminates to act differently from the way they did in history, that's perfectly valid. But from a writing perspective, writing a game is really about expressing a historical interpretation in a new kind of setting. It means thinking through how all of these roles will intersect and interact. It means thinking about the incentives and values and perspectives each one of your role characters has, each one of your roles has, and thinking about how to create an experience for players where they have the freedom to act differently than they did in the past, but they have incentives to move forward in roughly the same way. So it's a very different experience. I would say it's much more creative nonfiction than it is academic writing. But it does require you to deeply immerse yourself in the subject and in the people you're writing about.
Mm-hmm. It sounds fascinating and very challenging to me. So in other words, and now we're kind of getting into the mechanics of the games themselves. When you design a character playing a role, you have to sensitively describe their goals and the constraints that they meet, the resources that they have or don't in order to achieve those goals. Is that right?
Yeah. So this is where, so many people listening to this will have had experiences with simulations.
Yeah.
And there's lots of different definitions of simulations and I don't want to go into them here. I'll just say simulations tend to abstract. The reacting to the past games instead believes in the virtues of particularity. It wants, so you write the roles in a way that will help students immerse themselves in that role and in that time period. And some of that is mechanical, as you say, thinking about the goals they had and what knowledge they would have and what knowledge they would not have. But some of it is biographical, right? If students are really going to immerse themselves in that person at that time, they have to empathize with that person. And your writing is meant to help all of the students who will play it empathize with the people in the past and what they were seeing and feeling and fearing.
Yeah, I imagine that's very difficult to do because essentially you have to do a kind of caricatological, sorry, I didn't get that word out right. Character, how do you say that word? I don't know. You have to understand their personality.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in some sense writing 20 or 30 mini biographies.
Yeah. You have to understand the personality, where they came from, what kind of habits they have, you know, whether they run hot or cold or, you know, this sort of thing, if they're sick or well. Yeah, that kind of thing. And you can see that this is a really incredible task. I mean, it's the task of the biographer, but you don't have time to do that in class. So essentially you have to kind of sketch in order to give the students an idea of the way that they should act consistent with the character.
So
in that way, it's a little bit like method acting.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it very much is, I mean, I could give these mini biographies in a lecture. That's perfectly possible.
Yeah.
But students will engage with them more when it is their peers interacting with them as somebody else than they will simply. And, you know, I do a lot of recruiting. We talked about this earlier. As I've said, one of my taglines in recruiting is college is expensive and YouTube is free. You ought to get more from college than just somebody giving you information, because you can get that for free.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. And now we're kind of, again, a lot of random questions are occurring to me. Are there, well, let's first start to talk about the students. Do students react well to this? Do they enjoy doing it? Are there some that are a little bit hesitant to try it, or how exactly does it work in the classroom when you select students to play particular roles?
So many students are apprehensive at first. This is not what they are used to, although that varies from school to school. But many people are apprehensive about what they see as something that's more demanding, because, of course, you can't just slouch. I mean, I suppose you can slouch in a seat, but you won't be effective doing that. You actually have to participate. And many students, as you know, are nervous about speaking in public, whether that's a set piece speech or just interacting with their peers. My experience, and I should say, as I said, this was developed at Barnard. It initially took root in relatively elite private schools. It has since spread across to all varieties of American public education, community colleges, regional state branch schools, small private non-elite schools. My experience is that 80% of students love it. 10 to 15% of students tolerate it, and 5% of students hate it. Which is much better than I will get in a lecture, honestly.
I was about to say the same thing. And it's not even in a lecture that you could ever know, because they just sit there
kind of mute,
like, oh, this is going on again. Yeah, I can certainly understand that. So let's leave aside questions about what you do with problematic students in this context, because I imagine we get very deep into the weeds there. But what does it require from the instructor?
Yeah, it's a different... Well, let me start with a story. I was division chair of humanities for quite a while here at Newman, and I was at a a presentation to incoming students. And I talked a little bit about this and about how I sat in the corner and watched students play. And the dean of the business school kind of looked and laughed dryly and said, "So what you're saying is that we are paying you for not working." That is not actually right. It is a different kind of work. So I would say a couple things. One of which is you talk to students far more often when you're, the colloquialism is running a game. When you run a game in a class, you will see far more students in your office hours, in your text stream, if you give out your phone number to people, in your email box, you will see far more students than you will in a lecture class. You will see them because a little bit because it's an unfamiliar environment and they need advice and assistance, but mostly because they're much more engaged in the material and they want to win and they want your advice about what they should do. So from a time perspective, you don't, quote unquote, work real hard in the 50 minutes you're in the classroom, although even that's not completely true. But it is a lot of time spent engaging with students. I think that's a good thing. Not everybody does, but it's one of the most rewarding parts of teaching the games for me is getting to know students better and helping them one-on-one. It utilizes skills that graduate schools rarely teach. Now, I know graduate school has changed since I was in graduate school. When I was there, we got a ton of information about content, and we got a lot of information about how to do research, and we got a lot of mentoring about how to become professional. We got very little teaching about how to teach. And so being an instructor in a games class, in that environment, you use interpersonal communication skills and you use the skills helping to mentor people through experiences that are different for them. You use those far more than you would in a lecture classroom. I think students get far more out of that, but it is a different set of expectations or demands on you as an instructor. The third thing I would say is, as an instructor, the supporting materials that come along with the game walk you through the experience. And so that actually running the game is less demanding than the time and the skills necessary to help students succeed.
So after a moment, the game kind of runs itself. The students are in charge of it. You moderate, or what's the right word for it?
So you moderate is probably the right word. You will be called upon to intervene at times, right? Contingency is part of history. These are games in which sometimes you roll dice, not as often as you would in Avalon Hill games, but sometimes you roll dice to see if the riot by the crowd actually kills some of the delegates to the National Assembly, or to see whether the invasion succeeds, or mechanism of contingency is important for that game. And so you'll do that. Part of your job is to make sure that people are following the rules and know the rules. Part of your job is to help students in the classroom, is to help students who feel unsure. So I actually text students while they're in class, while I'm watching. I will text them and encourage them, just kind of prompt them and say, you know, your character really doesn't agree with that. I've talked to you in my office. I know that you know this. This is a good time to raise this point. And so part of your job is cheerleader in the classroom.
I do want to ask about a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One is your particular contribution to reacting to the past is called The Needs of Others, Human Rights, International Organizations, and Intervention in Rwanda, 1994. People are very sensitive these days.
Yep.
and uh, And, you know, trigger warnings and such, it strikes me that you're going to be asking students, at least you might be asking students you might be putting them in situations or presenting them with stuff which I hesitate to use the word traumatized, but it might, I don't know what the right word is. It might put them in a funk or something. Has there been any pushback from students about this or from administrators, or is it an actual danger, or is it just something I'm making up being overly cautious myself?
I think there's reason to be cautious. So let me tell, so again, maybe I'll start with a story and then kind of move on from that. So, I was walking into my classroom one day, and a young man who was playing the Rwanda game, Needs of Others, stopped me as I was walking in. And he said to me, well, I can't, I need your help making a decision. And I smiled my happiest, best smile, and said, well, what is it? And he said, well, my girlfriend, and his girlfriend was on the other side of the debate, my girlfriend was in my room last night, and she was writing her paper. And she went to the bathroom, and I read her paper, and I know what secrets she knows. Should I use this? And I looked at him and I said, you know, I can't answer that. And he looked kind of abashed, and he walked into the classroom. And about 20 minutes later, his girlfriend stands up and starts to make a point, which I knew was not true, and which I now know that he knew was not true because he had snooped in his girlfriend's paper. And he looks over again at me, and I just smile at him and I don't say anything. So he stands up and he starts to make his point. And in the middle of that, his girlfriend looks at him, and I can see on her face that she realizes what he has done. And before I can do anything, she says, "You asshole." And she storms out of the room. And the guy looks over at me, and I'm like, you know, this is your girlfriend? You do not want advice from me about how to solve this problem. That is a way of saying that one of the beautiful parts of reacting is that students become emotionally engaged in the game that they are playing. Now, this doesn't happen, right? We don't have those kind of crises every day. But students do become emotionally invested in their characters, in their victory, in their relationships with other people. And they become emotionally invested in the issues that are being addressed. That means a lot of things. One of the things I always say before a game starts is that you have to remember as you play the game that you are playing this as characters. And if you are a member of the crowd in the French Revolution and you are yelling at Lafayette and calling him scum, and Lafayette happens to be your roommate, you're not calling your roommate scum.
Right. Yeah, right.
You're calling Lafayette scum.
Yeah, right.
And every game ends with a debriefing period in which you cast those roles aside and revisit what happened and use that as an opportunity to understand why history unfolded as it did rather than in the game, but also to make sure that everybody understands that we're out of that liminal space and we're back to a world in which you can trust your roommate and be friends with your roommate and you don't have to hide that paper on your computer. So that's the broad answer. The more specific answer is there are clearly some games and some roles which are more emotionally demanding than others. Different instructors treat this differently. In my game, The Needs of Others, in particular, I doubt there are any students listening out here, the role of the French ambassador is very emotionally challenging. The role of the French ambassador is basically to stall and to make sure that intervention doesn't happen. Now, I know we can go into the nuances of that because stated that bluntly, it's not quite historically accurate, but broadly speaking, I think that's a reasonable interpretation of history. And so the French ambassador has to try and persuade people that this is not genocide. So we haven't actually set this up, right? This is a game that is set in the Security Council of the United Nations in April and May of 1994, and students are asked to respond to reports of increasing violence in Rwanda. And they're asked to do so with widely varying amounts of information. The people who play, for instance, the ambassadors for New Zealand or Nigeria, who are kind of instinctively inclined to intervene, don't have the kind of information necessary to make a persuasive argument. The French ambassador has lots of information, but doesn't really want other people to have it because it would undercut his argument. And so I've had students cry on occasion, not often, but occasionally. And I've certainly had students look at me and say, boy, that was hard to play. Individual instructors handle that differently. Some administer a survey before the game to try and get a feel for what students' backgrounds are and what roles and kinds of roles students can inhabit well. Other people do it randomly. But in every case, there should be instructions or guidance in the instructor's manual about these are the roles which may be emotionally challenging. Probably worth checking in with these students occasionally and making sure they're handling it appropriately.
How do you assign the roles to the students, or do they pick?
They do not. Oh, different instructors do it differently. I do not allow them to pick.
Yeah, I think that's wise.
Because, I mean, I have kids. I know how this works.
Yeah, me too.
What I do, I actually do administer a survey because some roles I will ask students what, are you an athlete? If you're an athlete, what part of the semester will you be out of town? I ask students, do you have particular talents, whether that's graphic design or singing or whatever it might be that might help you play a role, embody a role well? Do you prefer to be in a leadership position or do you prefer to be part of a group? You know, those kind of things. And then I try and, within reason, to match students' perceived talent and comfort with the demands of the role. But I will say I don't promise students that. And sometimes I will go against that because what's most important to me out of this is that students get a broader understanding of that particular part of the past that we're engaging and they think through what that time means for us today. So for the needs of others, for instance, I really want them to think about this question of what, on a personal level, of what rights and responsibilities we have toward people who are in danger, and how the structures and institutions we've created to help our world run, how those structures and institutions impact decisions about our own ethical and moral responsibility.
So this leads kind of naturally to a question. You did mention this just a second ago. How does one do assessment in a context like this? I mean, you know, the standard lecture, two tests, and a 15-page paper, that doesn't seem like it applies here. So how do you do it?
So every student, every game requires students to write. The form of that writing or the genre of that writing depends on the game, but every student is expected to write and to write from a particular background and voice. And so from a writing perspective, every game can be integrated into an assessment plan. Every game requires people to speak. And both in writing and in speaking, they are required to do so from the perspective and with the knowledge base of that particular character that they are playing. And so that's also a way to integrate this into assessment. To some extent, right? So people use these games differently depending on their own goals for their program and their class and their institution. And to some extent, assessment relates to how you choose to use games in the class. Some people choose to use one game in a semester as a way of particularly emphasizing one particular moment of time or one particular issue. Other people choose to use two or three games in a semester and abandon lecturing entirely. And to focus on themes across history or developing skills in thinking about history rather than the kind of essay or multiple choice question you might get in a traditional lecture class. But all of these can be assessed, and all of these can be used to, or maybe I should say, every instructor should use these games in ways that make sense for their own course objectives and for the objectives they have for their institution.
Mm-hmm. So is there a standard timeline for the, and standard, I mean that in a very loose sense, or a typical timeline for the use of these games? So for instance, if I were teaching one on the Russian Revolution, I might lecture for a few weeks on the Russian Revolution, and then I'd say, okay, now we're going to play a game, and that will last how many weeks?
So games take different amounts of time. They take, I think, broadly speaking, instructors often spend a week or so talking about the materials, the historical background, and we haven't talked much about this. Every game book has a historical background essay that's 20, 30, 40 pages long. Every game includes a variety of primary documents that students read before they start the game. That may be a book. The Athens game, for instance, asks you to read the Republic, or at least significant parts of the Republic. It might simply be a variety of excerpted documents. So the needs of others contain speeches and intelligence assessments and a variety of things like that. But you spend a week or so introducing the game. That is to make students familiar with it, not to make them know it perfectly. They will be teaching each other as they play the game. And then the game might take 2 or 3 weeks to play. A few games take longer, but not very many. And then you'll do a day or two or three of debrief. So basically 4 to 5 weeks is pretty typical for a full-length game. People use them differently. I teach a class on comparative genocide. Most of my students and colleagues wonder about my sanity, but I teach a class on comparative genocide. And I start with the Rwanda game because one of the critical questions in the Rwanda game is what's happening genocide? And so I want to start asking them to really interrogate that definition. How do we know what genocide is? And how do we know when it's happening? And what kind of evidence would we need to persuade us in real life that what's going on is genocide as opposed to, I don't know, typical violence? I also do it at the beginning because once you have established a classroom culture of participation, that doesn't go away. You may return to more traditional ways of teaching, but students are much more likely to ask questions and have discussions and make their opinion known or to follow you down a trail once you've established a classroom culture in which you encourage student, and that's not right. You always encourage student participation, but students grow to value their own participation in the class. Mm-hmm. But you can do it at any point. Some people end the class with that because they want to end emphasizing a particular theme.
So I have a couple more questions and then we'll let you go. You've been very generous with your time. One of them, I was reading some economics this morning for my sins. And
a lot of us have been reading economics over the last 2 weeks.
This morning. I read some serious economics this morning. Uh-huh. And economists, they tend to be cynical kinds of people, the dismal science and all. And a cynic would say, not a cynic exactly, but at least a skeptic would say, all right, great. Is there any evidence that this produces better results than lecturing or something else?
So there are two kinds of evidence. First of all, there's a broad set of studies which look broadly at the difference between participatory classes and lecture classes. And I think while there are some caveats to this, I think the broad conclusion is that students learn more effectively when they are engaged and participating than they do from lecture. There are studies specifically about reacting. This is relatively new, but there are several studies which show that reacting works and that students like it.
Well, it certainly is, let me just say, it certainly is intuitive to say it's really good to learn by doing. I mean, like, there's simply no question that if you do something, you're going to have a different kind of knowledge of it than you are if you learn about the theory of it. You know, like, I can't imagine, I always give the example of, like, riding a bicycle. Like, if you gave somebody a manual on riding the bicycle, say, here's how you do it. Like, they'd never ride a bicycle, but you have to show them. And then they start to ride the bicycle and, like, okay, they can ride a bicycle. It's just a very different kind of, it's a different kind of learning task because they're doing it. And that's very important. So it is intuitive that they would, I don't know if learn more or learn different. I don't know if these things can be quantified, but or typologized, but it is intuitive that it would be effective in many ways. Mm-hmm. So my second question before I let you go is this. Are there reacting to the past or something like it, role-playing like gamifications that would apply, or do these apply to other social scientific disciplines? And I'm thinking anthropology and sociology and political science and things like that. Mm-hmm. Are there people in those disciplines involved?
Yes. So I will start out by saying that even though I am a historian, I've been surprised to find out that this particular game is played more often in philosophy and political science international relations classes than it is in history classes. Huh. And so there are a number of these games that, while written by historians, apply to other disciplines. But even more broadly than that, there are scholars from across academia working in these. There are people who have worked in STEM fields. There are games asking students to debate the cause of disease in a cholera outbreak in London. There are games about climate change and the debate about climate change. There are games about evolution and how evolution has been implanted. There are political scientists who do this. There's an example. There's a Watergate game that is in the process of working its way through the system. There are not as many games that are not historical as maybe I would like. And if there are economists or anthropologists or other disciplines out there who would be eager to write a game, I hope that you do that, because we need games for those specific disciplines. But even with the games we have now, they're used in classrooms across the academic spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kelly, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. As you know, we have, at least I do, the way I do the interviews, we have lots of people that do the interviews and they do them differently. I always ask one question at the end. It's the traditional final question. And that is, other than sequestering yourself and recruiting students, what are you up to now in terms of research?
Well, my research is largely through reacting. And so I've got a number of games on the process, moving its way through the system. But what I'm doing right now is starting a new reacting game focusing on the Franco-Algerian conflict in the 50s and early 1960s. And it asks students to think about issues of decolonization and colonization. It asks students to think about questions about what kinds of violence are appropriate and are there kinds of violence that are never appropriate. And it asks students to think about a basic question that is, how do wars end? We spend a lot of time talking about how wars start. We don't talk nearly as much about how wars end. So I am deeply enmeshed in the history of Algeria and of France. And of I am looking forward in a week or two to writing the role of Charles de Gaulle, which, if there's not a dream thing for historians to write about, that's got to be it.
Yeah. I've always reminded about Charles de Gaulle. His name was de Gaulle. What's that?
Yep.
Mr. Gaulle. His name was of Gaulle. That's just whack. I don't even know what to say about that. That's like, it's like two story, but it's just bizarre. So anyway, Kelly, thank you so much for being on the show today. By the way, when you research France, we have a lot of interviews in New Books in History and New Books in French Studies that involve precisely Algerian French relations, so you can go listen to those, and I encourage everybody listening to this podcast to go listen to them too. So let me say thank you very much for being on the show, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks for having me, Marshall.